Okay, I have 9 o'clock, so I'm going to start. Anyone else who's coming on will miss the first minute or two, but it's time. Before I basically just have a few more minutes on Rav Zevin, and then we're going to move on to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. But let me just say a few more things. First of all, I've been meaning to get to this for a while. I don't know if you see this book here. Mesor Yosef Iyunim B'Morashato Shel Hagon Rav Yosef Kapach. This is Volume 7. We did classes on Rabbi Kapach. They've now, this is 2012, it came out a couple months ago. His followers put out a volume every year or so, dealing not just with his own thought, and it's a thick volume, as you could see, but also with thoughts, ideas that he's interested in, medieval philosophy, other things. And in here, you know, when we dealt with Rav Kapach, we spoke about the Rambam's position on taking money for teaching Torah. And I want to call your attention to this. I think page 71 and on, they have an unpublished tshuva that he wrote. He was asked by a student whether he could take money from his yeshiva. Because that was, you know, these are people who, followers of Rav Kapach, the Dardaim, they hold like the Rambam, that you can't take money for teaching Torah. We spoke about how the Rav Kapach himself, when he was a Dayan, took money, but the truth of the matter is, that's not a problem, because the Rambam already tells us in Hilchos Sanhedrin, if you take a look, it's in, I have it down here, chapter 23, that a Dayan, this would include a Rav, also could take money, what they call Schar Batala, like a doctor, because he could be doing something else, and Rav Kapach was he was involved in jewelry, so he could have made money. Although it does say here that he gave back all the money that when he was starting to work as after he left Merkaz HaRav, and he made money from his jewelry, he gave back all the money from the yeshiva that he got from them. And also when he used the money that he got from a Dayan to repay the money he got from the yeshiva that was supporting him. So he never took money for teaching Torah. But so what's the answer to the question then of the student? Everyone knows that according to the Rambam, you can't take money for teaching Torah, and therefore the whole system in Israel, according to the Rambam, is fraudulent, etc., etc. Rav Kapach replies no, that you can take money in Israel. He's not talking about in America, but even according to the Rambam, you can take money for studying Torah. And he explains that he's not getting money really from the Rambam's position is that you can't put yourself on the community. However, this is different because the government decides through the Misra Datot, through the religious ministry, to give money to people studying Torah, just like they give money to people studying in the university, or they give money to culture and sport. And first of all, he says it makes no sense to say that all these other people can take money, but someone learning Torah cannot. And more importantly, this isn't, no one's putting themselves on Balabatim and saying that you, community, you need to support me. This is a choice made by the government to support, and therefore it would be very different. I actually argued, in any event, that the Rambam's position is when you have to be supported. But if you're supported individually because another Jew wants to support you, that's fine. And the Rambam himself did this. He was supported by his brother. He only had to become a doctor when his brother was drowned in that accident. And that's what Kavach says here. It's when you... They create a system here where individuals, as it were, are taxed. The community decides that the individuals are taxed to pay for these people learning. But with the government, you could say that's the same thing with the government, that they're taxing. But Rav Kapach thinks it's different. Rav Kapach thinks the government has taxes, and of the tax money that comes in, it determines what to distribute. If the government were to, today, if everyone in yeshiva were to stop going into yeshiva, it's not like the tax rate would be reduced. It's just that the government would have more money then to give to maybe that's different than if in a religious community, like if we have a town and we put a tax on everyone to fund a yeshiva so people could study. According to everyone else, that's okay. According to the Rambam, that would not be okay. But that's Rav Kafech's decision. But even in America, we do not have the system like they had in Germany, where you have a kahila system where we tax people. In America, everyone gives tzedakah voluntarily, so therefore no one is really on the public dole, as it were, and therefore I'm certain, and Rav Kafech, I believe, based upon what he says, agrees that the Rambam will not have a problem with the system as we have it in America, because all of our charity is voluntary here. And as I mentioned, the Rambam never had a problem with voluntary donations. He himself was involved with this. Some people want to say that the Rambam, there's two aspects here. There's the private aspect and also the fact that the Rambam was involved in the business. That is, he gave money to his brother, so he was sort of involved, so that way his brother could support him. But I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue, if you look at the Rambam, his commentary on Avot and elsewhere, I think the issue is clear. That it's when people are obligated, the person is a burden on the community. But if I, as an individual, want to support someone, then that's, the Rambam's not referring to that at all. Okay, and I see Baruch agrees, so good. Three other points, including something Baruch pointed out to me, I'll get to in a minute. The story that we spoke about last week, or the week before, about Reb Chaim not wanting to paskin on matters of divorce, matters of aguna. Instead, he gets a telegram from Yitzhak Elchanan. This book came out in 2012. Maybe Bill remembers this person from YU, although I think he's a little older than you, perhaps. His name is Menachem Martinman. He's lived in Israel for many years. He wrote an excellent PhD on the medieval philosopher Yaakov Anatoly, who was the son-in-law of Shmuel Ibn Tibon. And then I never really heard it from him. He wrote some articles early on in the 60s and 70s, and then he sort of disappeared from the scene. I don't know what he's been doing for all these years. But he came out with this book. I know he's a classmate of Rabbi Rakefet, because I've heard him mention him. And here, on page 42, he says that he thinks the reason that Reb Chaim, and this is based upon Rabbi Soloveitchik, that Reb Chaim, as a theoretician, he could not put practical halacha inside, he has these categories. The strain to which the pure categories of halacha would be subject in such cases is too much. In other words, for Reb Chaim, everything is theoretical. And therefore, it can't bear the strain, as it were, of putting it into practicality. That's basically Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. His name is Martin Gordon, but he calls himself now Menachem Martin Gordon, and the book is called Modern Orthodox Judaism, Studies and Perspectives, 2012. Next point. Bill pointed this out to me, and he gave me a page number in Rabbi Schachter's book, Mipnine Rav Soloveitchik, that came out in 2001. Now, I have 2001. I have two editions, actually. Because one I have online. There's a 2001 edition and a 2005 edition. And the 2005 edition is not the same page number, and there's like 50 more pages. But I started from the beginning, and it doesn't seem like anything new has been added. It's just that the pages are not divided the same way. They end pages earlier, so I don't think anything is new. But on page in the standard edition, page 222, he tells the following story. That when Beryl Soloveitchik, that's Revelvel's son, when his firstborn was born and they had a bris milah, Israel Zalman Meltzer and Rav Zevin were both there. And at this event, the brisker Rav starts bad-mouthing those people who were in the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate. This story comes from Rabbi Yerucham Gorelick, who himself was a character. I know for a fact that Bill remembers Yerucham Gorelick, but I don't know if he were in Ashir. He was one of the YU I've written about on the Svarim blog, how today the children and grandchildren who are so right-wing, they actually deny, you know, we have a principle that you can't deny, and no one will deny something that the people who are eyewitnesses to and can testify, and there's literally thousands of people who can testify to the fact that Rabbi Yochum Gorelick taught Talmud at YU. With plenty of people in his shir, but they actually claim, or at least one of them claims, he never taught Gemara there. He sort of was like a mashgiach ruchani. But it's hard to imagine, but they have said that. And incidentally, my post, which I mentioned already, is going to be up. They've been keeping it for so long, because the guy who puts it up had all sorts of conflicts. But apparently tonight they tell me my post, and there's an unpublished Satmar-related document that will be up. Has never appeared in print. I know it's going to turn some of your stomachs, but that there's a reason I didn't want to put this up before I was in Rav Tenor's show, because I knew he would have yelled at me for putting this thing up. But you'll see it. But getting back to the story, this comes from Rav Gorelick, and it's according to the story, at least. I don't know how if it's true, but it's told that Rav Zevin was there too, and Rav Zevin starts arguing with, rebuking basically the Brisker Rav for all the negative things he's saying about the Rabbanut. I have a little bit of a hard time believing it, only because Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, although he wasn't officially in the Rabbanut, he was tied in with all these people. He was with Rav Herzog, he was with Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the cousin of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, if I recall. So they're all one mishpacha. He was very close to all these people, and although he wasn't officially in the chief rabbinate, he was really a part of it. He was one of the people who was responsible for the Moatzat Datitz that they had, the religious council. So I don't know, but if the Brisker Rav, who respected Rav Zalman very much, would have said this in front of him. In any event, that's the story. And the upshot of the story here is that Rav Zalman Meltzer was so upset by this dispute that when he came home, it bothered him so much that he threw up everything he ate. That, he didn't like to see this fight. But that's the story. The name of the author, this is Aravar Mishu's Bris. Yes, that would be the Bechor, I believe. Again, it's hard to know if this is a true story, but Rav Gorelick was not there. Rav Gorelick lived in America, but he was a student of the Brisker Rav. He was in Brisk for many years. He even gave the Hesped, there's a picture of it, when the Polish president died. He needed someone in Polish to give a, because Brisk was part of Poland then, if I'm not mistaken. You needed someone to give the Hesped, the public eulogy. And we have a picture of Yeruchim Gorelick standing up in the public square there, giving the Hesped. And I've already put on the Svarimbog a picture of a young Rav Yeruchim Gorelick with Rav Baruch Leibovitz. So, I think you can basically rely on what he says, but I don't know whether he was just repeating something or whether it's reliable. And finally, before we move on, a couple classes ago, I told, maybe it was last class, or two classes ago, from this book, Olamo Shel Abba, the crazy story, which I'm going to repeat again in one of my blog posts of why we wish the bride and groom happiness, like Adam and Chava, because at least in the days of Adam and Chava, you didn't have to suffer through a rabbi giving a drasha at the wedding. And I mentioned that, I don't know anyone today who really gives a drasha. I mean, our rabbis, they speak for 2 minutes. but I said, apparently they do. Now, Baruch says, and people can confirm this, it's his understanding in the Nebroyers community there still is a drasha. Anything more than 5 minutes I count like as a drasha. So I don't know if anyone knows Nebroyers, if they do or not. Okay, so we can continue now. Baruch says that he says that for those who are not watching live, that in Europe it is more traditional that, and it's common that there's more of a drasha by the Rav at the wedding. That used to be something they used to do. Let me go on now. I just want to finish. I understand nowadays. And Shalmo says in Toronto, so tell me, when you say they do a drasha, how long is this drush? I assume this is under the chuppah when bride and groom are both standing there. Tell me how long this drush is, because even we have it in the modern Orthodox community. The rabbi will speak, but he'll speak for 2-3 minutes. You know, he'll give a charge, as it were, to build a bais neman. He'll give a tiny vort, 3-4 minutes. You won't see more than that. Oh, so Shlomo says buy the meal for 20 minutes. Okay, yeah. I can see why Rabbi Miller said that here we want to be mesameach, and the Rav gets up at the meal and speaks for 20 minutes, that we can wish them that they should be like Adam and Chava, where they didn't have to, because who wants to hear a drasha at the wedding? Okay, thank you very much. So Dov says, I repeat this now, I've been told by many people, also to repeat the date, it's December 3rd, I think, 2012, that Dov in Chicago says there's Don Aiden because there's no in-laws there. Okay, that's a real funny one. Okay, let me just conclude two more things about Rav Zevin. I'm supposed to do next Rav Avadi Yosef. I think I'll just do after Rav Yitzhak Khan in the early years, and then I'm going to move into Rav Yechezkel Abramsky, who we've mentioned already in the Rav Zevin talks. I found something interesting that Rav Yechezkel Abramsky and Rav Zevin had an agreement that they would not speak about chametz. Chet stands for Chabad, Mem stands for Mizrahi, and Sadi stands for Zionism. In other words, these were the three issues that Rav Abramsky and Rav Zevin, who were the closest of friends and who had suffered together in the Soviet Union, yet they cannot agree on Chabad, Mizrahi, and Zionism, and therefore they had an agreement when they got together not to speak about Chametz. And finally, one more point. I mentioned to you that it would be great if someone were to gather together all of Rav Zevin's articles in Hatzofeh, which he wrote for many, many years. One of the articles, which it hasn't been put together, the only ones that were put together were the articles dealing with his reviews of Torah literature. But he wrote on topical themes, he wrote about governmental issues, all sorts of things. One of the things he wrote about, and I haven't seen the article because unfortunately Hatzofeh is not yet online. I hope one day it will be. You can get microfilms of it if you're at a place like Harvard. Maybe in JTS I know has some as well, but I don't have access to that now. There's a description of it in this book, Heaven at Bay, The Jewish Kulturkampf in the Holy Land by Emil Marmorstein. Now, Emil Marmorstein, well, first let me tell you who his son is. His son is Rabbi Avraham Marmorstein from the Upper West Side. Emil Marmorstein, he's the one of the rabbis in the Upper West Side. He gives hashkachas. I think his shul is the Minchas Chinuch shul. He's a well-respected Rav on the Upper West Side. I know he reads my posts because he emails me about them as well. I gather, although I know I haven't met him, that he's more in the Haredi side of things. Emil Marmorstein's father was Arthur Marmorstein, who taught, although he was a rabbi from Hungary, an agudist from Hungary, who comes to London, gets a PhD. He might have had his PhD already in Hungary. He teaches at Jews College and wrote a number of important works, including a number of important books in English. That's Arthur Marmorstein. He says, now, Emil Marmorstein is a strange character if there ever was one. Now, I would write what I want to say about him normally on when I deal with him, because I am going to deal with him, but now that I'm not going to say I'm friends with Rabbi Marmorstein, but, you know, when I write things, he emails me, and we have nice conversations, so I have to be more careful. After all, I'm going to be speaking about his father. But Emil Marmorstein is someone, and I even have a letter from Louis Jacobs dealing with him. He goes to Oxford, or Cambridge, I think it is. A typical Englishman growing up would have grown up to be one of these English-style rabbis. He has a very large secular education, beautiful writer. I mean, this book deals with, you wouldn't know his religious political views from this book. This book just deals with, it's published in, he's an expert in the King's English. This is published in 1969, Oxford University Press. Today, I just saw that 70-some percent of Israelis think that the biggest issue facing Israel is not the Palestinians, but this the conflict between the secularists and the Orthodox. So he's writing about this in 1969, many years ago. Somehow, he gets involved, I don't know if this is when he was at university or later, with Satmar Nature Karta ideology. And I still remember at Brandeis University, when I was a student there, they had copies of this journal that came out, published by Nature Karta in London. It was in English, it was called Hachoma, or Light, something like that, like an English version of Hachoma. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's still there on the stacks. And if you know how these Satmar Nature Karta types write, you're not usually dealing with people with who write English, as if this is their native language. Here you have Emil Marmorstein writing eloquent, if I can say the word eloquent, eloquent Nature Karta type articles. The only one I guess you'd have subsequent to that would be Schiller. I don't know if people know this, but Meyer Schiller, who teaches at MTA, is really Nature Karta, although not the crazy Nature Karta of the people who go speak to Ahmadinejad, but a different style Nature Karta, but still anti-Zionist. He's also a Hirschian. He's also a white separatist. There's all sorts of things in this very brilliant man, Meyer Schiller. But so Emil Marmorstein becomes Nature Karta, and what's crazy about this is that I'm told by Ben Elton, who's written on a British Orthodoxy, including an entire book, he's working on another one, that at the same time that Emil Marmorstein is Nature Karta and writing anti-Zionist stuff, which no one could understand, and I'll publish the letter from Louis Jacobs, what a shock this whole thing was to anyone who knew him, his wife is president or chairwoman of Mizrahi of Golders Green. Now, how that worked out, I don't know. I have all sorts of interesting information from Emil Marmorstein, among them of which, towards the end of his life, he davened, I'll just tell you this because it's in the news, he davened at a Beis Medrash, those of you who are in London know what I'm referring to, Reb Chunah's Beis Medrash. Reb Chunah, who's Reb Chunah? Reb Chanan Halpern, who's, he's gotta be, well, in his 90s now, an old-fashioned Hasidic Rav, who are really very much on the right wing. There are signs in his shul against, I've been to his shul, against carrying in the Erev, signs in his shul, all sorts of crazy signs in his shul. So why did I mention Reb Chunah? Because Reb Chunah's son is maybe, or was until 2 weeks ago, the most important Haredi Rav in London. Nothing less than Hasidish Rebbe, not his own branch. And that is Rabbi Chaim Halpern. And if you've been reading at all the news, you know who Rabbi Chaim Halpern, the equivalent, I mean, we don't have in America, I mean, most people haven't heard of him, to know how big this man was and how important he was. To try to think of a downfall, you'd have to think of one of the big Rebbes, like the Satmar Rav in America or something like that, or one of the big Rashi Yeshiva in America, to think of a downfall like this. And the story is unbelievable. I know someone who's been feeding me sort of information from the inside before it even broke. That is, before the name broke. Now it's public knowledge. And so that gives you a sense of who this Emil Marmorstein was. So let me tell you, so what does he deal with Rav Zevin? Because there was this case in, does it have the year here? What was the early 60s, 61 I think it was. There was a boy named Yossele Schumacher. His grandfather was they came from the Soviet Union, his grandfather and his parents, and his grandfather was still one of these people who had remained Orthodox, even though he had been in the Soviet Union. His son was not at all observant, and his son is one of these people, I don't know, just couldn't make it in Israel, decides and makes it public, he's going back to Russia. And he's going to take his son, obviously. That is, the old man's son is going back to Russia, and of course he's going to take his grandson. The grandfather kidnaps. I guess it was one of the days that he was spending time with his grandson, and it was time to give him back to his son, that is, give him back to daddy. He doesn't give it back. He says he is not giving his son back. His grandson, that is, the father, is not giving back his grandson to his own son because he is refusing to allow him to be brought back to the Soviet Union where he will be raised as an atheist. So this, if you recall, remember that case when this mother took her son, this is about 10 years ago, to go to Florida. They left Cuba, and the boat collapsed or something, and the mother was killed, but the child was rescued, and the father's still in Cuba, and the father wants the child back, and the people in the Cuban community here were saying that the mother died bringing him to freedom, but of course the father has parental rights, and the kid was eventually sent back. So it's a similar sort of case. The father obviously has parental rights, but to take him back to the Soviet Union where he could be raised completely assimilated. And then there's the religious element. You had many people saying from both the non-religious and even in the right-wing communities that halacha precludes giving back a child if he's going to be brought to such an environment. I guess you could probably make a case that, I don't know, maybe one day if we ever have a Haredi government that non-religious Jews, their children can be removed from them. I'm sure you can make a pure halacha case that non-religious children can be removed from their parents to be raised religiously. I'm not saying that'll ever happen, but you can be sure someone will start arguing for it. So this didn't just go on for a few days. This then became a cause célèbre because this was going on for months. And the police had no clue. And the father, I don't remember if they even put him in jail or they threatened to put him in jail. That is, the grandfather, he refuses to give the child back. And newspapers started publishing headlines, "Where is Yossele Schumacher?" So what happened was the Mossad had to get involved with this. I mean, this was an unbelievable case. There was a point where every single letter, I have a book on the Mossad, which says that every single letter from overseas that was being sent to Israel was being opened by the Mossad and read. And it's a long story. What happened was that the kid was smuggled out and he was kept in Satmar homes around the world. The woman who smuggled him out, her name was Ruth. I forgot her last name. This is the woman who later converts and becomes... I think she might have already been converted at this time, but not yet married to... She was Jewish, but when she went overseas, she dressed very fashionably. She eventually marries Amram Blau, who is the head of Naturei Karta. But there's a whole story as to how you can read up on it. There's actually two versions of the story. One is that the Mossad used a... They knew that one of these Hasidim was going to this prostitute or group of prostitutes, and they were able to get pictures of him and use that to blackmail him to find out where Yossele was. And I forget, was he in New York when they found him? I forget now. The other story, I have two books on the Mossad. The other story is that they set him up. That is, they like kidnapped him, Mossad, and they put scantily dressed women all around him, so it looks like he was with hookers. And that's what they found him and brought him back. Now, in the midst of this dispute, Rav Zevin writes an article in which he basically he tries to have both sides. He tries to tell the parents, you know, if you want your kid back, you know, it's not it shouldn't be a question of what's right or wrong here. It's a question of getting the kid back. And if you want the kid back, you should agree to, you know, keep him in the land of Israel. But he does say, let me read it to you what he says. He also arranged that there was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, Yitzhak Zidia Frankel, arranged a compromise that, you know, the grandfather would tell them where the child was if they would remain here. But Rav Zevin says as follows. He says basically you have to be realistic, that these people who have him are not going to give him back. He says, a simple question confronts the parents. Which would you rather have, your son Yossele or the punishment for the guilty? Certainly, from the point of view of justice, the restoration of the child is not dependent on any condition. And he goes on, but from a realistic standpoint, this is what we need to do. What I think is interesting, and I'd really like to see the article, is that, this is Marmorstein, Rav Zevin maintains that in the halachic view, there was no doubt that the parents were fully entitled to the care of their child. I would like to see Rav Zevin make this case, because, speaking frankly here, I think it's a hard case to make. If you have a parent who wants to take the child back to the USSR, what was his reason? He had been among the 107 signatories for appeal for repatriation on the grounds of misery in Israel. So I mean, if you're going to take a child back to where he is going to be raised as an atheist and no Judaism, I'd like to see the halacha case that Rav Zevin made that even in such a circumstance, I see you from a utilitarian standpoint, from a practical standpoint, we have to give all the parents the rights. And we can't take kids away from parents, and the parents have the rights. Halachically, I would assume it's completely usher for a parent to smoke at home. But what are we going to do? I mean, we can't realistically. What can you do? And even in our government, what we can't pass laws. But I would like to see in this article if Rav Zevin just states this as a fact that parents are entitled to the children, or if you can make a case, if he actually makes a case, because we have examples from halacha literature where a parent wants to bring a child to become an apostate, to be baptized. And the post scheme always assumed in such cases that the parent lost rights to the child because the parent was then going to, as it were, you know, remove the child from Klal Yisrael. Well, you know, bringing a child to communist Russia to be indoctrinated there, it's not that much different than baptizing a child. So, again, I'm not arguing for this point from any in any realistic way, but if, as Marmorstein says, assuming what he says is correct in his summary of Rav Zevin, or Rav Zevin argues, and I'll read it to you again, that in the halachic view, there is no doubt that the parents are fully entitled to the care of their child. I would like to see that. Shlomo says it was Rav Yaakov Schlesinger. What, the child was found with Rav Yaakov Schlesinger in London or in New York? Because Schlesinger was in both London and in New York. He was the grandson of Yaakov Rosenheim, the Agudo leader, who we might also in my post, my new post, I speak a little bit about Yaakov Rosenheim. Yaakov Schlesinger today is also really Satmar, even like the Troy Karta leaning rabbi in London with very extreme viewpoints. Rodney says Schumacher is now a scientist. I saw that interview. Oh, not in Homodia. I saw an interview in one of the other Israeli papers, Haaretz or something. You can easily find it online. And he described the story of his kidnapping, and I had that exact experience quite fondly. I think Hamodia might have reprinted it. And he had a relationship with, I think it was Ruth Blau, right? It wasn't someone else. I think it was her. He had a relationship, continued. Oh, no, sorry, I'm confusing this. Ruth Blau had a son who did not go with her, the Neturei Karta route. And because Ruth Blau was living like on a religious Zionist kibbutz before, then she went crazy and became Neturei Karta. I don't recall the Schumacher interview, but the Ruth Blau's son's interview, he's still alive, and he described his relationship with her after she went crazy. She wrote an autobiography also. I believe it's in Hebrew and French, not in English as far as I know. Okay, with that, we end Rav Zevin, but if anyone has any comments, any final comments or questions on Rav Zevin, I will wait 1 minute before I move on to the next figure that we're looking at. His picture's appearing on the screen. And by the way, if you recall what Baruch said last week correctly, actually, this picture doesn't really show it. I have a picture. There's a picture, though, if I recall, of Rav Zevin. Of Rav Yitzchak Chanon, like with a strimal. There are many Rabbani, not one of those Marek Espotic ones, but if you look at him right here, I mean, he's a Lithuanian gadol, and he's obviously not dressing modern or anything. He's dressing like a traditional Lithuanian gadol. Okay, so no one, I see Baruch's typing, but no, there was no episode at his Baruch asked, was there a dispute at his wedding, at his funeral? In fact, if you look at the art scroll in the volume, one of the volumes, I think it's made the Hasidic Tales, the hardcover that has a dust jacket, it describes his funeral, how you had the Merkaz people there, you had the Hasidim there, you had everyone. He was one of the people who was pretty much respected and loved by everyone, except for the extreme, you know, Neturei Karta, Satmar Tais. But everyone loved Rav Zev, and he was able to cross all these boundaries. So Yidol tells us that Schumacher isn't observant nowadays. Well, why would he be observant? I mean, he was brought back to his parents. His parents weren't observant. They would have needed a little more time to keep him in the group he was. This is important historically, though, because this became an Israeli government thing. It's not just that the police was looking for a missing child. There's lots of missing children. But this became an issue of parental rights, of religious secular disputes, and it was clear they had to bring him back. Okay, so let us move on. We're now going to focus on Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who is, his dates are 1817, 1896. He is one of those larger and life figures whose influence towered over a generation, and this was a generation full of great figures. In terms of the figures we've looked at, who is he comparable with? In a sense, he's comparable to the Chassam Sofer, but not the equivalent. I say this because the Chassam Sofer had influence over the entire Ashkenazic world. I mean, the entire, from anywhere you were in the Ashkenazic world, the Chassam Sofer was the dominant figure. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan is often referred to as the Posek Hador, Gadol Hador, things like that. But the truth of the matter is, Posek Acharon, this is really a Lithuanian perspective. This is a very Lithuanian yeshiva world perspective. So if you're in the Lithuanian world, it makes sense to refer to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan this way. And Lithuanian poskim and writings from that world routinely refer to him in this fashion. However, the Hungarians had their own poskim. The Hungarians never gave up their autonomy because of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and the truth of the matter is the Hungarians never cared about Rav Yitzchak Elchanan as a posek. They had their own poskim, and they have their own canon of poskim and sparim, which they use, and great figures in the Lithuanian world that's not even part of the canon. They don't even know these people. Just like the Mishnah Berurah is so important for us in the Hungarian Hasidic world, what do they need the Mishnah Berurah for? They have other Sfarim that the Sai Halacha. They have the Sivos's work. It slips my mind now. Was it Derech? I forget the name of it on Halacha. They have other works. So to speak about Rav Yitzchak Elchanan as the Posek Hador, which quite apart from the fact you're forgetting about the Sfaradim. The Sfaradim had great halachic authorities at this time. But even for the Ashkenazim, it's not just a Lithuanian perspective. It's Lithuania. The German rabbis look to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, so it encompasses Lithuania, it encompasses Russia, but it definitely does not encompass Hungarian Jewry, and it doesn't encompass the Hasidic world, obviously not. But having said that, in the areas where he was accepted, which was most of Ashkenazic Jewry, he had a standing, much like the Chassam Sofer, in that there wasn't anyone at his level. There was no one, really, who could stand up to him. Even the Netziv, the great Netziv of Volozhin, doesn't measure up to him in terms of authority, in terms of psak, as we will see. Yeah, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Oh, Derech HaChaim. Thank you, Bill. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is again. You had many. You had other poskim people wrote tshuvos. It's just like in the yeshiva world today. I mean, from Wiedenfeld, the Dovid Misharim. I mean, he was a great posek. But in the Lithuanian circles, he's maybe the one non-Lithuanian who's accepted, but they don't put him on the same level as non-Lithuanians. That's an old story. His significance is seen in many ways. First of all, we will see examples of this also. Plenty of big rabbis, very important rabbis, were reluctant to take certain steps without Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's approval. The Heter Mechira, which we'll deal with, is only the most famous. But there are plenty of other examples that where great rabbis would not make a decision without the approval of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's Spector. And without Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's Spector, the Heter Mechira would not have happened at that point in time when it did in the late 19th century, because the other rabbis, we'll see, Rav Moliver and the rest of them, of Zemel Klepfish and the Yeshua Samalko, they were not going to take this step on their own. They made it conditional. It would have happened probably later on. Rav Kook on his own could have given this decision, but it would not have happened when it happened had it not been for Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Let's not forget that the Netziv who maybe is two or three in terms of important post scheme in Lithuania, was opposed to it. So no one was going to go up against the Nitziv unless you had someone of the stature of Rabbi Yisrael Chanan Spector. By the way, as we'll see, it's not just the Nitziv, the Rabbanim in Jerusalem were opposed to it. So the Heter Mechira is going to be interesting, because how often do you have a case when an outside Rav comes in and gives a psak against what the local rabbis, and we're not just dealing with, you know, local public rabbis here, we're dealing with Gedoli Yisrael, Mara D'Asra of the land of Israel. You had Rav Diskin, Rav Shmuel Salant, they were opposed to it. Rav Yitzhak Hanan nevertheless decided to overrule them. They had an interesting approach, because as we'll see, I'll just anticipate this, you needed the Beis Din in Jerusalem to, you know, do the Heter, but the Ashkenazim wouldn't, so the Sfardim. They used the Sephardic Beis Din. So they, from their standpoint, they were not violating the autonomy of the post scheme of Eretz Yisrael, because they said the Sephardic Rabbanim will institute Rav Yitzhak Hanan's Heter Mechira, which is exactly what they did. Rav Yitzhak Hanan was born in a small town in, I should have put up a map, but the town is meaningless, in the Grodno district. His father was a Rav there, and there's biographies, there's even a hagiography. In the last 2 years, there's a Haredi biography, but it's not a hagiography. It's not an academic biography, but it's in the middle. It's a serious work. And then there's this thing, Rav Yitzhak Hanan Spector, which is written by this Rabbi Plato. I don't know who he is, Menachem Mendel Plato. And this is complete hagiography. It's not a serious work at all. The other work is found in the Machon Yerushalayim is reprinting his Tshuvos, and they included it there, and it's also found separately. And that's a more significant work, and I'm even quoted in that work, if I recall correctly. My article, in fact, yes, I am quoted in that work. My article on sale of my article on Esroge Corfu, which appeared in the journal Or Yisrael, which is a rabbinic journal, on Rav Yitzhak Hanan was very much involved in that. So that was nice to see myself quoted there. We are told in the hagiographies that his father was offered other rabbinic positions, but he liked the small town life and he refused. As with all these stories in hagiographies, who knows if this is true? How does anyone know? This hagiography tells a story that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was not very bright as a youth, and he only achieved what he did through his enormous efforts, and this is supposed to show everyone that even if you're not so bright in yeshiva, you too can be great if you work hard enough. The problem with this story is that if you look at the biographical descriptions of Yitzchak Elchanan, the Hespedim, and all the rest that were published by people who knew him, people who knew him from many years, shortly after his death, at least in what I've seen, not one of them mentions anything approaching that. On the contrary, all the Hespedim and the biographical descriptions that appeared in the years after his death describe him as a genius from his youth. And that from, which is to be expected, as a genius as a child. So I assume that this hagiographical story is just another one of these phony stories made up. You know, they wanted to find some great rabbi that they could say he really wasn't so great in his youth. It's just through hard effort he became great. And, you know, they decided to put it on Rav Yitzhak Elchanan. But all the evidence is on the contrary, that he was recognized from his youth as an Eloi and a great genius. Now, mind you, just because you're an Eloi doesn't mean you don't learn. Of course you learn. It just means that you learn and immediately you remember things and you see your greatness. I stress this only because Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, there was this crazy case in Israel something like 30 years ago where there was these stories going around that there was this child that, like a 3 or 4 year old child, it must have been a Gilgul of someone else because it knew Shas, it knew all, you know, and great rabbis had questioned this child, and this child who's never been taught anything knew Tanakh by heart, all these things. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook said that it's forbidden to believe this. If I'm not mistaken, he even said it's heresy to believe this, because the definition of Torah is working at it. And the Torah is never given free. as no one is ever given Torah. Anyone who has Torah knowledge, it's because you worked for it and you acquired it. And therefore, to say that there's someone who's born with Torah knowledge, the angel forgot to get rid of the Torah knowledge, that's forbidden to believe, because that goes against the whole concept of Torah. All it means is that those people are geniuses. When they spend 3 hours, they accomplish a lot more and remember a lot more than anyone else who spends 3 hours. And that's how Rabbi Yisrael Hanun is described. I was going to get to that in just a minute. Baruch, you're anticipating me. Very good. But Baruch, I'll mention what Baruch says in a minute. He quotes Zalman Alpert. Zalman Alpert, a librarian for many years now of YU, is a resource on Hasidus, on anything. He helps all sorts of people. And all of my books, including my new book, the book on censorship, I give a hearty thank you to Zalman Alpert. You heard the same story, and then Dove says he heard the same story on the youth in Netziv, which is interesting, because usually you don't hear this. Usually the typical story is how they were geniuses from youth, and I'm reading the biography now, or the hagiography of Rav Avadya Yosef, put out by his grandson, which I love these hagiographies from the family, because hagiographies in general, you can always get good stuff out of them if you use them carefully, but they're always careful not to put things in that could be controversial. But the family often doesn't see something as controversial. So like when Rav Avadya says something for the family member, that just is natural. Someone else might be reluctant to include it, but this hagiography includes it. They talk about how Rav Avadya Yosef, as a child, how much he knew. They even show examples of there when he was 12, 13 years old, he was already writing Svarim, and I mean, he was a genius from youth. Okay, before we go on, I saw someone mention something here. Let me move up here. Bill says that Rav David Friedman and Yosef Shaul Nathanson were contemporaries. Yosef Shaul Nathanson, not really so much in the Lithuanian world. David Friedman, yes, but Nathanson dies, before he. Before Rabbi Yisrael Hanun, at least 10 years before, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Yisrael Hanun, so didn't have to compete with him. Or David Friedman is really contemporary, but David Friedman has not had nowhere near the influence in terms of universal authority of Psak. Okay, let's move on. Let me just pick up what the Baruch says. His father was a student of. I don't know if he's called in the source I have, it doesn't say he's a chassid. But he's a student of this Rebbe, Rebbe of Amdod, who was spreading chassidus in Lithuania. You had a small chassidus in Lithuania. It's specifically, the source that I saw specifically does not say that he's a chassid. It says that he's a student of him. So does that make him a chassid? I don't know. I mean, did he function like a chassid? It's hard to say. They don't describe it that way. They describe him as, I guess maybe somewhere in the middle. I can't say, how much of a chassid was that. But this, Rav Chaim Chaikel was a Talmud, who, Baruch just mentions, was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezrich. Rav Yitzchak Hanun, though, studied with his father. He didn't really have any other teachers. He didn't go to yeshiva. In those days, you didn't have much in the ways of yeshiva. You had Volozhin, Volozhin was around, and Mir was around, but that's really it. Most people went to the Batei Midrash, and they studied. You can go to famous ones like Eishishak, but you went to different Batei Midrash, and then the Rav would give shiurim. He didn't really do that. He only studied with his father, with one exception. He also studied at, there was a Rav Binyamin Diskin, who's the father of the Rav Diskin. We'll get to Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, who later becomes a Rav of Brisk, and also of Kovno, and then goes to Eretz Yisrael. He was the Rav of Kovno before Yitzchak Hanun, and he studied with Rav Binyamin Diskin, because he was the Rav of the city that Rav Yitzchak Hanun's in-laws were. But that's it. Other than that, it's all with his father and on his own. No, he didn't go to Harvard, and he didn't go to Yale. And I said I see why Baruch applies Harvard, because Shlomo says he's a chassid like you and the Tolna Rebbe. Yeah, I guess so. I told you though, the Tolna Rebbe, Professor Tversky, didn't. He usually was spot on, but he really misjudged me. we had to do, I had to do, like, long examinations, written examinations before you get a PhD. And one of them, I wrote on Halacha in Modern Times, Psak. And after reading it, and I wrote some stuff about Hasidus, he said to me, and this is a quote, that you have a chip on your shoulder when it comes to Hasidus. And, which then he said something like, and that's okay, you know, if you want to be a follower of the Vilna Gaon, that's fine. But it was really very wrong. I was describing in an objective manner what the problem the Hasidim had, the Misnagdim had with the Hasidim, and he saw it as if I had a chip on my shoulder. I don't think it's true, because, first of all, part of my family, I mentioned it, has this Chabad background. I went to Chabad camps. I don't think that I have any prejudice against Hasidim, but whatever, he thought I had. And he functioned as a Rebbe, a bit of a Rebbe, if you lived in Boston. I thought for a minute there you were going to mention, those who have seen the news, it was sent to me by Lawrence. I don't know if he's with us here. He's not with us. Is Larry here? Oh, yeah. If you haven't seen it, email me. I'll send it to you. The new president, he was provost before, the new president of Yale, Salavoy, is a descendant of the Soloveitchik. Well, he's part of the Soloveitchik family, going back to the brother. The news report, the article that appeared in the Yale Daily was mistaken. It described him as descendant from the Beis Halevi. It's not true. He's his forefather is a brother of the Beis Halevi. His forefather, actually, is a son of this Rabbi Eliezer Eliyahu Tzvi Soloveitchik, who, if you remember my Sfarim blog post, he's the guy, the strange one, who wrote the commentary on the book of Matthew. And I included a picture of him in the post. Anyone, if you haven't, I can get you the link to this. That is who the new president, he also wrote it, by the way, this Eliyahu Tzvi, wrote a parish on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, but the new president of Yale goes all the way back to the Brisker, not Brisker, to the Soloveitchik dynasty, which takes you back to Rav Chaim of Volozhin. So he has real yichus, and he recognizes his yichus. He's proud of it. He's not like some of the people who couldn't care less. In 1837, before I go on, Joseph Gruss was named after the Sholem Meshiv. I did not know that. The great philanthropist Joseph Gruss, Baruch Hazus, was named after Yosef Shaul Nathanson. So I did not know that. In 1837, he becomes Rav of a city called Sabalin, which is nearby. Again, not an important town at all. He's 19 years old, and one of the people who gave him smicha was named Rav Yitzchak Chaver. Who is Rav Yitzchak Chaver? That's the title of one of his books. Rav Yitzchak Chaver, who was the Rav of the city of he became Rav of the city of his in-law's city. Sorry, Rav Yitzchak Chaver was Rav of the city where his in-law is in, and he was a great Talmud Chacham. He's known because he was a Mekubal. He wrote books on Kabbalah. Actually, I just reminded myself of something I want to check and show you next week. But most people are under the impression that there was no Kabbalah in Lithuania. And that is true for a time, basically, for maybe from like second half of the 19th century on to World War II. You don't have much in the way of Kabbalah, but even then you have exceptions. Rav Yoshev's grandfather was a big student of the Kabbalah, Rav Kook, of course. But you always had some. And the Gra was a great student of Kabbalah, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Rav Yitzchak Chaver was also, and wrote a number of works. The one I have right here, Magen Vitzina, is a book he wrote against, this is the reprint edition, you can see on HebrewBooks.org the original. It's a book he wrote against a rabbi in Venice. Any of you who come with me this summer to Venice, we will see his grave. It's the only grave we go to. The only cemetery we go to is in Venice. Rav Leon Yehuda Aryeh Modna, we've mentioned him a few times, who was an anti-Kabbalah person. He wrote a book called Ari Noheim, which is against Kabbalah, and Rav Yitzchak Chaver wrote a book, Magen Vitzina, against this. What I think is interesting, which I don't know if it's a coincidence, is that Magen Vitzina is also, not a very usual name, is also the name of a book that Modna wrote. Modna wrote another book called Magen Vitzina, and that is a book a defense of Torah Shebaal Peh against these, you can call them neo-Karaite people who were living in Venice. You had these people who came over from Spain and Portugal who were former Muranos, and when they come and become Jewish again, they don't want anything to do with Torah Shebaal Peh. They basically want a biblical type of Judaism, and it's a form of Karaism. And Modna writes a book defending Torah Shebaal Peh called Magid Vitzina. This must be some sort of inside joke or statement or something, I don't know what you call it, that Rav Yitzchak Chaver would pick the title of the book, the very title that Modna uses, maybe to show him that it's, say that, you know, it's a good title. And you yourself, Modna, wrote a good book when it came to defending Torah Shebaal Peh, but the truth of the matter is, you know, Magain in the defense, now I'm going to one up on you, use the same title, and defend Kabbalah, which you were wrong on rejecting. It strikes me as very strange to think that Yitzchak Chaver did not know the book Magen Vitzina, written by Modna. But that's just an interesting point. You know, now that it occurs to me, I'm going to check the dates. What date did Modna's appear? It was published, believe it or not, by Abraham Geiger, who himself was a great opponent of the oral law, but he was also a scholar, and he published Modna's book, and it is on, fortunately, it's on HebrewBooks.org. You know, one day someone's going to tell the guy who runs it that, hey, this is a book edited by Geiger, and they'll take it off, so save it right now. Rav Yitzchak Chaver, by the way, his last rabbinic position was in Suvalki. And anyone who went to YU should know who the last Rav of Suvalki was. And even Baruch, who didn't go to YU, I'm sure knows who the last Rav of Suvalki was. It's Rav David Lifshitz. He was the last Rav of Suvalki, and that's Rav Yitzchak Chaver's position was there. His last position. Now, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was only Rav in this place, Sabalin, for 2 years. And we're told that he, as was always the case, he received a very small salary. And he then became Rav of another town, not an important one, Baresa it's called. Other than Rizal Chanan being there, I never heard of it of any significance. Although it's a more significant city in the sense that the train, when they made the train actually went there. Smaller towns, you'd have to take a carriage from a town like Baresa to go to somewhere else. But the train went there. During this time, that is from 1839 and on, he begins to write Shelot and Shuvot. And we know that he was called to sit upon Dine Torah. So people take notice of him. He's a significant Rav. Following this, 7 years later, in 1846, he goes to a bigger, more significant city. This is the rabbinic pattern. You start small and work your way up. So you get to more significant positions, if you can. Nizhvez, it's called. I don't know offhand of any great rabbis who were there. Like we'll see in the next two positions that Rav Yitzchak Chaver was in, he follows in great, great rabbinic figures. Here, too, we see, and we have Tshuvot from his responses, the very Yitzchak and Yitzchak written during this period. I see it's already 9:58, and I want to get involved in a... Okay, well, I have time to do one more, just tell you about this tshuva. In Evan Ezer number 10, it's an interesting question. A man married a woman without permission from the government, that is, he didn't go and get the proper secular permission. When this became known, the government said, you have to divorce her. I don't know the details of why they would say that, and Rav Yitzchak Chaver doesn't explain it. He couldn't divorce her and then remarry her immediately. But when he came to Beis Din, he said, they asked him, are you divorcing out of your free will? And he says, no, he's doing it because the government says he has to. He later returned and said he wants to give her a divorce of his own free will. The divorce was given, and Rav Yitzchak Chaver was asked if this was proper, because after all, it's the same situation here. Is this a divorce? Even though he says he's doing it on his free will, is this a divorce due to pressure of the government? And Rav Yitzchak Chaver says that the divorce actually falls under the category of Beis Din forcing him. Since the government will not permit him to marry his wife, the Beis Din has responsibility to force him to divorce her. I guess din the machusadina. Therefore, the get is valid because Beis Din can force you. Now, following this, he goes to Navardik. We'll pick up next week. Rabbi Yisachon of Navardik. Navardik is already a big city, and you had a great rav there in the 19th century called David Navardik. If you know Shilas and Shuvas literature, he wrote the sefer Shtuchalakim, if I recall, Galya Maseches. So Navardik is already important a city, and following Rabbi Yochanan, the great Aruch HaShulchan, Yechiel Michal Epstein is Rav in Navardik. So we will pick up next class with Rabbi Yochanan as he moves into Navardik. We have two more classes. I will stop now. It's 10 o'clock. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining us tonight. And those of you who email me because you listen to the tapes when they're sent to you, but I'll stay on for a few minutes for some questions here. You know, Rodney, I don't know where in Newton you live. I was in Newton 2 weeks ago. Which shul are you in? Are you in? There's only two shuls there. Okay, so I was not there for Shabbos, but I know the shul. I've been there in the past. I was with the Nywood family. If you know the Nywood family. And I know lots of people in that show, not just Jonathan Sarna and all the academic types. I know others as well. Okay, thank you. My email is shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. Okay, everyone. Well, it was, and by the way, Rodney, not the post that's supposed to be up tonight, although who knows, he's been telling me this now for a few days. The next one will have, and I give you credit, the piece on Rav Hinken. You get credit for finding it, but it'll be my commentary on what this says about the Haredi world that, well, I'll leave everyone in suspense. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Good night.